Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. For today's episode, I'm speaking with the writer and Substacker, Noah Smith, about the big topics that I really think folks should be focusing on in 2024. Obviously, we are going to discuss the Trump versus Biden result we all are certainly going to see this November after the New Hampshire primary. After that, we get into Noah's areas of expertise. We focus on the future of war and the lessons from Ukraine and what that could possibly mean for conflict in Taiwan. We then get into industrial policy, manufacturing, and how we can actually implement the goals of reshoring our semiconductor capacity despite all the challenges over the past few years. Really hope you enjoy this conversation, and Noah is seriously one of my favorite writers on the broad economic, tech, and defense topics we're discussing, so folks should definitely check in on that, especially the sections on the arsenal of democracy, which is an area that I'm increasingly focused on myself. Noah Smith, welcome back to The Realignment.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Okay, Noah, so here is the big idea for this episode. Obviously, we're recording this the day before the New Hampshire primary, but at a key level, it's pretty clear it's going to be Trump versus Biden. And that means the year of 2024 is not going to be a year of big policy debates or big defining issues. It's going to probably be a culture war battle to the finish. So I want to take this as an opportunity to basically go over the big topics that you write about that in an ideal world, we'd be focusing a lot of our political discourse around. But before we get into that specifically, I'd just love to hear your opening thoughts just on the Trump versus Biden dynamic.
I think that America is a very partisan place where people tend to project everything they don't like about a country onto the presidential candidate of the party that they don't want to vote for. So, and I think that by and large, Republicans want to vote for Republicans and Democrats want to vote for Democrats, and Republicans will come up with ideas, you know, reasons to think that a Democratic presidential candidate is, you know, the worst thing since Hitler. And Democrats will do the same. I mean, Mitt Romney was a pretty reasonable guy, but Democrats did come up with reasons to think that him making the offhand comment, binders full of women, was sexist, or, you know, and then people always come up with a reason to think that the reasonable ones are horrible, which makes it very difficult to tell when we're facing a truly horrible candidate. And so I think that that's the problem, this sort of signal extraction problem that we face. Because what happens when, you know, we cry wolf so often, that what happens when that wolf comes? With Trump, I think in many ways the wolf has actually come, which is to say, I think that Trump's policies during his first term in office were not, the most horrible, worst policies, you know, we ever saw. There were some bad ones. There were some bad things that he did. But overall, you know, it was not a disaster for our nation. So I think it's somewhat easy for Republicans who are inevitably talking themselves into voting for Trump again to tell themselves, well, okay, you know, Democrats said it was going to be this huge disaster and it wasn't a huge disaster and blah, blah, blah. But I think that that really neglects Trump's real importance, which is as a degrader of institutions, which he's always been. So when Trump lost the 2020 election, he claimed that he did not lose. And, you know, basically went on this giant months-long challenge slash tirade that at the very least inspired people to do the sort of coup attempt of January 6th, which, you know, no one who votes Republican wants to call that a coup attempt. It just really just hurts them to think those words. But it was that's what it was. And so, but, you know, Trump was basically making a lot of Americans think that our democracy is a sham. There's all this voter fraud, even though they never found evidence of any. And that degrades people's faith in democracy. You know, the whole point of democracy is to get widespread buy-in. You know, it's to get everyone thinking, we chose our leader. We collectively as a nation chose this leader. But when you say, oh no, you didn't really win, it was all fake. You know, there was fraud and fakery and blah, blah, blah. When you say that, I mean, you know, obviously in some countries it's true. They really do have faked elections. But when you say that it was, you know, fraud and fakery, you're subverting the basic purpose of democracy, which is to make people feel that they made a collective choice and that the will of the people is spoken. And so now, you know, a lot of Republicans think that the will of the people did not speak, that they were cheated of their win, cheated of their victory. And Democrats had occasionally done things like this too. You know, Stacey Abrams lost an election and then cried foul.
There were some objections in 2004 over Ohio on the congressional floor.
I remember Bush versus Gore. So while I think that Democrats have not been, blameless on this front, I think that Trump really turned it up to 11, on the election denial front, to the point where people were prepared to go in and violently try to, overturn the certificate, violently prevent the certification of an election in the U.S. Capitol. And because of what Trump said, whether or not he actually called them up and said, "Hey, go do this." And so I think that that is kind of scary. The other another institution is the military. I think that the military stood very strongly against Trump's attempt to hold on to power in 2020. We have, all these transcripts or in quotes of like Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, saying like, we're gonna land this plane, and like this isn't gonna turn out to be like Hitler, blah blah blah. And then afterwards, there was a lot of attempt by the U.S. military to look for people who sort of supported insurrection, and there was like a slight internal purge of the military. I don't know how big that was, but there was, maybe a little bit. And after that, you saw all the Trump followers saying our military is weak, it's woke, it's traitorous. You saw a lot of rhetoric against the United States military, and so that's very disturbing. I do not want to see the president attacking the military. I do not want to see the president trying to purge, the military of people who generals who won't support his attempt to overturn elections. That's I really don't want that. I do not want that to happen. That would be a really bad thing. In terms of alliances, international alliances, we know we're facing a very stiff challenge here from China, Russia, and Iran. That is the most powerful alliance against us that has ever existed. It's more powerful than the Soviet alliance during the Cold War. It's more powerful than the Axis, relative to us. It is more. That's a really powerful like alliance of people against us because of Chinese manufacturing power, Russian sort of energy, nukes, aggression, whatever they've got, spies, I don't know. And Iran's just ability to make trouble in the Middle East, which is obviously a very divisive region, as we're seeing now with the Israel conflict. So that's a very stiff challenge to us, and especially China. If China weren't part of that, it would be kind of a joke. Putin plus Iran would not be that scary of an opponent without China's, incredible manufacturing might in the mix. But it's really powerful, and to stand against that, to sort of preserve the world of trade and of, American independence. Where we can, sort of do our own thing, without foreign countries telling us what to do. That is really going to take, and of course, to preserve our alliances, that's going to take strong cooperation with our allies in Europe, cooperation against Russia, our allies in Asia, cooperation against China. Trump really does not like those alliances. Trump has already said he's going to abandon Taiwan. Came up with some flimsy excuse. He said this the other day. He wants to put tariffs on our allies. He wants to constantly start trade war with our allies and withdraw from NATO. I have no doubt that he would try as hard as he can to do this. And with the unchecked power that he seems to be, arrogating for himself, saying I'm going to be a dictator and other things like that. What the hell are you talking about?
Well, I just want to raise something because you actually wrote about this, and I think
Like
you
he
put
could
it
do
very
that.
eloquently when you pointed out that obviously Republicans in the Senate put forward legislation to make it so that Trump could not unilaterally withdraw from NATO on day one, as people predicted he would. But I think the key thing is Trump, as commander in chief, could do all sorts of things that even if by letter of the law we were still NATO members, it operationally wouldn't make any difference when it comes to Europe or broader American positioning.
Right. So right now we are legally obligated to defend Estonia if they're attacked, if Russia invades them. Okay. But so Trump, even if he didn't withdraw from NATO, if Congress stopped him from doing that, suppose Estonia gets invaded and they say, "Help, help, help." And Trump says, "Don't do it. Stay in your barracks, military," and just refuses to do anything. Well, Congress can censure him, impeach him yet again. Which doesn't do anything. They can do whatever they want, but no aid will be forthcoming, and Estonia will be conquered. At that point, everyone in NATO knows that the United States is not coming to help them. Therefore, NATO's dead. Like the day that Article 5 becomes a joke, the day that a NATO country gets conquered by another country and incorporated in another country, without NATO coming to its aid, even though it invokes Article 5. The day that the United States refuses the call of Article 5, it doesn't matter if we're legally in NATO. NATO is a defunct alliance. And that's the end of that. Then the Europeans on their own against Russia. And that's the end of NATO. And so we are barreling toward that. Russia has declared its intent to do this. You know, everybody sort of agrees that after Ukraine, if Russia manages to conquer and subdue Ukraine, the Baltics are next, especially Estonia, where there is a decently large Russian-speaking population that provides an excuse to attack and conquer. And so, and of course, Poland would be next after that. The Europeans are not blameless. Obviously, they have been incredibly, especially the Germans, have been extremely weak and, definitely trying to free ride off of America. Germany's prime minister said that, you know, if America fully withdraws support from Ukraine, then we'll think about increasing our ball. It shouldn't take that long. They should be ramping up as much as they can right now. But despite saying again and again, you know, we're going to ramp up our military spending and ammo production, all the stuff, they just haven't done it. They just, you know, bullshitted and didn't do it.
And I think what's frustrating there, too, is that
it's very frustrating.
Given the poll numbers, which I'm still pretty bullish on a Biden victory, given the turn the economy is making. We'll get into that a little later. But if you're a European leader right now, this isn't like in 2016 where everyone wakes up on November 8th and holy crap, Trump was president. We didn't think that could be possible at all. We have to scramble. You're getting years of warning and preparation when it comes to the NATO question you raised, the defense picture you're raising here. This really is just this difficult, incomprehensible reality where it's just unclear where the Europeans' heads are at if they believe this negative case against Russian expansionism. It genuinely doesn't make that much sense.
Right. It really doesn't make sense.
Taking to that pivot then, I think you laid out a good list of both like your beefs with the Trump administration, but some big questions. Where do you stand on how President Biden has handled all of these issues? Because these issues are very active as we speak. This isn't like we're going to wake up in 2025 having to confront them. Like, how would you assess his performance?
I would say that Biden's performance on most of these things is really good. Biden handled the Ukraine war incredibly well. That's a thing that's going to stick in the craw of a lot of people who have been, you know, absorbing the message that Biden has mishandled Ukraine in some way. But he didn't. He actually handled that well, really well. He gave weapons to Ukraine. He did not give like all of our weapons to Ukraine on day one, which a lot of Ukraine supporters have a problem with, the idea of drip feeding. Which came from Jake Sullivan. But that worked because it meant that, you know, it's like a staged investment. You know, as Ukraine proved that it could fight with continually better weapons, we gave them better and better weapons, and they proved then they could use those. And so, you know, the amount of support that we gave to Ukraine was absolutely appropriate.
I want to get your thoughts on something. I hang out in hawkish Republican circles that are not quite, I think, aware of the political dynamics that drove the slow drip strategy. Their counter to that is, look, the reason why Republican populist support for Ukraine has collapsed is because the war has taken too long. If we just given the Ukrainians the weapons they wanted from the start, the war could have been over quicker. It wouldn't be kind of our situation right then. I'm curious like what you think about like their attack on the slow drip strategy.
Well, okay, so I think that the first thing we gave Ukraine was a bunch of defensive weapons, especially javelins and stingers, right? And that was extremely effective in blunting the Russian attack. Of course, Ukraine used its own artillery. We could have given them HIMARS earlier, but I don't, I'm not sure. They had so much of their own artillery, you know, from the Soviet days and whatever, that I'm not sure they actually had the people to learn on the new things. You know, they already knew the old things. They already had artillery. They could have learned the new artillery, but I'm not sure. You know, HIMARS is low in volume, and its main effect is to hit depots well beyond like enemy front lines to disrupt logistics. And the early days of the invasion, that was not necessarily the priority. The priority was just there were a bunch of Russian tanks running around everywhere, and you needed to blow them up. There were a bunch of Russian planes flying sorties, and you needed to make it too risky for them to give air support to the tanks. And the weapons that we gave them were incredibly effective. Ukraine won the Battle of Kyiv. They evicted the Russians from the entire north of the country, and they won. And then they won subsequent battles when we gave them HIMARS. They then won subsequent battles, taking back Kherson and Kharkiv and that whole area.
The
And
first
they,
counteroffensive.
yeah, and they, you know, they were very effective with all these weapons. We could have given them like F-16s earlier, but I don't think that would have necessarily been decisive because I think if you can get overwhelming air superiority, that can be decisive. F-16s wouldn't have done that. They would have marginally increased their capabilities. Tanks are just not that useful to the Ukrainians because it turns out that in the modern world of ubiquitous FPV drones, suicide drones, and HEGMs, very light shoulder mounted HEGMs. I mean, this thing, Javelin weight, like to carry it around, it weighs like 15 pounds. It's nothing. You carry it around and then you can like take out a tank at like a kilometer or something. It's nuts. Tanks are now in a support role. The idea of tanks is this powerful thing that can break through, go ahead and break through enemy lines is done. There's too many things that take out tanks. It's like the Javelin or similar things on Russia's things are not quite as good, but they're serviceable. And these sort of man portable ATGMs are basically like when musketeers were able to shoot the horses of horse archers, of steppe horse archers in the in like the 1400s, especially the 1500s, right? And then sort of this mounted horse archery thing that had sort of ruled the battlefield since at least the time of Genghis Khan, probably earlier. That whole thing just evaporated because now some untrained peasant with like a day of training to shoot the stupid musket could shoot your horse out from under, your warrior who's been like practicing horse archery for their whole life. And now, horses can't just like break through stuff. Cavalry's done, like heavy cavalry charge, that's done. That it just you if infantry can shoot cavalry, cavalry can't break through. And that is where we are now because the light long-range ATGMs and FPV drones, which can both be carried by infantry, mean that infantry can shoot cavalry. And so the idea of,
I want you to explain something because you actually wrote about this and it gets at the awkward dynamic. So in eras of warfare, offense versus defense in terms of which side is favored is incredibly important. And a point you made is that a lot of folks have this vision of Ukraine being similar to World War II. So it's a blitzkrieg question. It's a how fast can you get your tanks into which location? Tanks are essentially armored cavalry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But instead, what we're seeing is a much more World War I style situation where defense is favored, stalemates are forward. You're spending weeks fighting over limited kilometers in the first place. Could you talk about the implications for this being more World War I than World War II in terms of how we're conceptualizing the battlefield and the challenges themselves?
So World War I was defined by defense for a simple reason, which is that everything that we had invented to create mobility, forward mobility, would basically at that point, forward mobility meant horses, right? The only way to go fast was horses. And now that of course, you could shoot horses, that became true years, even a century earlier. But basically, World War I, you had machine guns and barbed wire. And that prevented infantry from being able to go forward either, and also more artillery. But you basically had these barriers to infantry, so that's why you're all in the World War I movies. You're always seeing people go over the top, boys, and then they all get shot. And so then, so that's how it works. And so the tactical defense basically won in World War I because we didn't have anything that could get past machine guns, artillery, barbed wire, and trenches. We didn't have anything that could get past that. Then Winston Churchill went and invented the tank. Well, he assembled the team that invented the tank and had the idea. But then,
PM of the tank.
yeah, he's the PM of the tank, actually. So to make up for his sort of debacle at Gallipoli. But anyway, he goes and assembles the team, that invents the tank, and the tank can bust through. It doesn't really bust through in World War I because they don't only make a few of them. It busts through locally, but and then they were unreliable. They broke down a lot. Then World War II, they made large numbers of tanks, and they were still unreliable, but more reliable. And you could really bust through trenches and bust, just go past lines. And then once you were behind enemy lines, you had this thing that could move and shoot. right? It had this big gun and maybe a machine gun too, but like this big gun. So once their tanks are past the enemy line, you just boom, 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 blast everything. And so you can really break through. It was mounted archery again. And so you saw World War II center around. Of course, people came up with shoulder-mounted HGMs, bazookas, right? That kind of stuff, Panzerfaust or whatever. And then, it worked, but you had to be really close. And so you needed, and it was sort of like dumb fire. We didn't have like accurate things. You had to walk up and shoot at a tank really close. And whereas tanks could hit you from a long way away, and the infantry supporting tanks could shoot you as you walked up, and because they had line of sight. And it was just very... people predicted that HEGMs would stop tanks, but they didn't at that point because tanks could go fast and were powerful and were supported by infantry. We used combined arms, and that equilibrium largely held. Tanks could still bust through, but we had to keep adding more and more stuff to protect them from increasing threats, right? We had to add all this fancy armor. We had to add air support and other things like that and do increasingly complex combined arms warfare. We're probably to the point where now, of course, neither Ukraine nor Russia can do combined arms warfare as well as America. We can bomb everything.
It means air. It means the artillery. It means all right. These factors coming in together, because if you just have the tanks, that doesn't work. If you just right. have the air, that doesn't work. You have to have all of these factors together at once.
And maybe we could achieve breakthroughs versus the Russians or whatever if it was us. But like, first of all, most armies aren't us. But second of all, I don't even know if we could do it anymore, given all the drones, right? These drones cost really little money, and a human can carry them, and one can take out a tank easily. So even if they don't have fancy ATGMs as good as the Javelin, they've got drones aplenty. They use like giant swarms of drones. Every infantry soldier is now equipped with a drone, right? You have your own drone. And sometimes it's just used for spotting, but then you can put a little warhead on it and basically blow up a tank. So any person can shoot a tank with a drone now. And so, of course, we'll use electronic warfare to try to stop that. That's adds another layer to the combined arms. We'll have close-in weapon systems, little, gun things that drive alongside the tanks and shoot down the drones, et cetera, et cetera. The point is that once you make it, like, what does a tank protect you from anymore? Like a rifle, a hand-carried, like, AK-47.
Other tanks.
Other tanks, which is, who cares? But, like, but also a machine gun. Right. Like only the smallest, what used to be a big deal on the battlefield that tanks protected from is now not that big a deal. Like tanks don't, there's not much left that tanks protect you from. And so the incentive to create this massively complex combined arms structure just to protect your tank advance when your tank doesn't really protect you against almost anything, then is going away. So the point is the cost just makes no sense. Battleships became obsolete. You could still create giant like destroyer screens and aircraft and blah, blah, blah to protect your battleships. But why? Why would you do it? What did the battleship get you? And really nothing.
Versus an aircraft carrier, which
versus
is the
an
key,
aircraft carrier. Yeah.
The key distinctions. Okay, so this is where, statesmanship and strategic thought becomes important. What are the implications for technology shifting warfare much, much towards the defensive when it comes to U.S. foreign policy? You had a piece that explicitly says like, hey, like U.S. foreign policy right now needs to be about maintaining territorial integrity, aka the defensive. Our question isn't, hey, how do we get to Moscow before winter sets in? It's, hey, right. How do we prevent the Russians from getting into Poland? How do we make right. sure an invasion of Taiwan is deterred? Talk about like the defensive implications of what this means for U.S. foreign policy then.
Right. So what we need to do is produce lots of stuff that is lots of denial weapons that can shoot down the enemy's stuff.
Can you clarify what you mean by denial? Because I think that's key for folks.
I mean that we need to produce lots of things that shoot down big armored things. We need to produce lots of anti-air missiles that shoot down planes. We need to produce lots of anti-tank missiles that shoot down tanks. We need to produce lots of anti-ship missiles that shoot down ships. We need to prevent lots of all these things and also systems that shoot down drones. But especially, so if you're talking about Taiwan, you're talking about, China coming in with planes and bombing stuff, and also coming in with ships and landing stuff, right? And then, so we need to be able to shoot down those ships, shoot down those planes. And when I say we, I mean Taiwan and us, we'll, if we get in that war, which I think we should, because, if we say we're not going to get involved, that's an invitation of China to attack. But we'll cover that later. But basically, we need a whole bunch of missiles that can shoot down ships and planes. Taiwan needs that. And Ukraine needs, you know, missiles that can shoot down planes. And Ukraine needs a lot of, you know, stuff that can stop artillery or, yeah, stop infantry, you know, stop missile attacks. And you know, they already have stuff that can stop tanks, but they need it in quantity. And so the thing about defensive weaponry like this is it has to be produced in great quantity. If you look back to World War One, the way Britain and France with our support ultimately won World War One was by outproducing the Germans. The Germans situated in Central Europe without access to overseas colonies could not easily get materials, and they got exhausted. Even after Russia got knocked out of the fight, the Germans got exhausted. And in the very end of the war, the Entente powers, Britain and France, had access to American material, which was essentially infinite at that time because America was a giant manufacturing country. And we were the China of the day, of the old days. And you know, they had also strangled Germany with this blockade. And Germany didn't have these like British colonies to draw on. And so Germany just lost because they got exhausted. You know, they
which leads to, by the way, the part of the stab in the back theory, which is that if we're successful in the battlefield, if we're knocking Russia out of the war, how can it be that our war effort could collapse without Germany being occupied? And that's because they lacked that critical industrial capacity that you need for modern warfare.
Right. No, Germany had the industrial capacity. It's just that they couldn't sustain it. Yeah. No one could have. Like, they were the best. They were really, really good at manufacturing, but they were small. You know, it was just them. And America was big, much bigger than Germany. We manufactured more because we were bigger, not because we were better at manufacturing at that time. Britain had access to its colonies and had this giant overseas empire. And so it wasn't that Germany was not good at manufacturing the weapons of war. It's that it couldn't do enough.
Yeah.
Germany didn't exactly have a NIMBY problem, right? They really were incredibly efficient at getting the most possible out of their war machine. It wasn't enough in the face of such a huge, overwhelming opponent.
So we need you to clarify something, because usually when folks hear the term NIMBY, they think of NIMBY as relating to, if they're even that deep in the lore, NIMBY is about like housing construction, YIMBY, right. NIMBY is like whatever. Why are you bringing up the term NIMBY when it comes to defense production?
Right. So suppose we want to make a missile factory, right? So we can churn out huge numbers of missiles. Well, a couple things we need. Number one, we need the raw materials for that, which means we've got to make 10 other factories to make those raw materials. We don't have those factories. People are going to say, I don't want that factory near me. And they'll block it. And they'll use environmental review to, you know, make it take years and years to build that factory. And they'll, you know, they'll try to push it somewhere else. And everyone will try to push the factory somewhere else. And then if we try to make the missile factory itself, people will block that too. So they will block the chemical plants, the steel factories, blah, 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 that we need to build those missiles. And so, you know, the same people who block housing are going to block defense contractors, right? They're going to block defense factories. Now, that's not the only problem. We have a lot of problems besides NIMBYs. You know, we have the big companies like Raytheon and whoever, McDonnell Douglas and some of these
Lockheed, you know,
Lockheed Martin. I mean, sorry, not McDonnell Douglas, Lockheed. Yes, you know, those guys do a lot of stuff where they try to monopolize stuff and then they make it too expensive. And then we've got problems with defense contracting where, you know, we don't actually fund the things and then funding gets cut off. And then we need to do like multi-year contracts. There's a lot of specific things we can get in the weeds of how we fix this. I'm going to write yet another post about it. But I think that multi-year contracts are sort of the one thing that everybody agrees needs to be done. Politically, we have problems. Republicans won't release the funds for defense stuff. Republicans used to fund defense in the days of Reagan. Now they're blocking it, and they're using that as a to extract concessions on other things. So they're saying, like, unless you cut this welfare program, or you know, you restrict abortion, or various other things they want Democrats to do, we won't release the military funds, and then our military production will get weaker, and then you'll look soft on the military, Biden.
And at the same time, you don't quite have a Democratic Party with the constituencies or coalition or groups who see themselves as being in that Reagan-esque role.
Exactly.
Which is the awkward dynamic for the Biden administration is, on the one hand, Biden explicitly thinks to themselves in FDR terms, right? Like, this is the New Deal era. The awkward part is the New Deal era leads into the Arsenal of Democracy era, which actually starts during the New Deal era. That's like a 1938, 1939, 1940, 1941 dynamic. So you're really going to need, especially if you get a second Biden administration, I think I may end up writing about this, but you're going to need the Democratic Party under Biden to recognize that, like, that is kind of their role. And you can't just expect the Lindsey Grahams of the world to fill that part of the coalition anymore.
That's exactly right. The Republicans have been very unhelpful because they don't want to see Biden have wins and they want to extract concessions from Democrats. But Democrats have been very unhelpful because they don't know who they are. You know, the Democrats are a deeply divided coalition and nothing has shown that as much as the Israel conflict. You know, Democrats are just extremely deeply divided. And to some extent, they're the governing party, at least in the presidency, but they still act as if they're a disparate collection of outgroups against the Republicans. And the Democrats still think they're the rebels. They're on the outside and they're all just a whole bunch of people who have to sort of work together against the Republicans. But then as soon as the imperative to work against the Republicans is temporarily receded, they start fighting each other. Democrats have always been a circular firing squad. In this case, that doesn't mean that all the Democratic factions are equally good or bad. Obviously, I support one of the factions. You know, the leftist the leftist faction of the Democrats, who in Congress calls themselves the progressives, but then outside Congress will call themselves socialists or something like that. Those people are not just idiots, which they are, but they are inimical to the project of America. They are anti-American in their outlook, and they believe they are as isolationist as Trump.
Wait, so quick question, and this is where this gets incredibly complicated but relevant. I disagree with AOC on most questions. No. I would not argue she's as isolationist as Trump. Are you confusing AOC with not just Twitter?
Not
right?
AOC.
Because like the Twitter, not just so like so. Wait, so who are these progressives? Who you would say which progressive socialists, et cetera, are you talking?
Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, to some extent, Ilhan Omar. Those are kind of the main three that do this. Ro Khanna, who's a congressman near where I live. And I know him. I know him personally. However, he has definitely thrown in with this faction and is like consistently against more military spending, wants to cut military spending.
Ro Khanna's in such a weird place.
I think he really is.
I think he's caught in this Gen X / elder millennial dynamic where they're both trying to recognize, to your point, the governing point, but they're also kind of trying to reach out for these constituencies that don't inherently lead anywhere. So like, he's manufacturing guy, right? So he's writing a big foreign affairs essay on how America needs to be the big manufacturing country. But when you start talking about the things that you're talking about, Arsenal of Democracy, China competition, etc., he's definitely a dove on both topics, which if you're actually looking at what's actually causing the votes to be passed, what actually unites the coalition, it's the China dynamic. So it just ends up turning into this like dead end politically that doesn't go anywhere. But it's so because he was an undersecretary in the Obama administration. So like he is serious about manufacturing in that focus area. But I'm just like really fascinated by these figures who kind of find themselves during dead ends in a realignment period where you're trying to say like, okay, what's this next thing going to be?
Yeah, exactly right. Yep.
Like so, I guess so. So then you. So you.
He threw in with the wrong group.
What? Basically, then, if you're looking at this dynamic, then, you're a younger Democrat. Everything you've written about this, like everything on social media, everything in the NGO industrial complex, all the foundations, et cetera, are basically saying you need to directionally throw yourself in, like with the left. What would your advice be for like a younger Democrat entering the situation? How should you conceive yourself and navigate this dynamic?
I mean, if you look at who actually wins elections, you see that the leftists don't win many. Many of their chosen candidates have failed. They tend to win only in deep blue districts where they can win a primary, a closely contested primary, and then run unopposed against a Republican. And then, then they get to the Congress and they're just as the same as any other congressperson. Because they won that primary. And so I do not think that Democrats need to be aligned with the left faction to win. And if you look at, for example, John Fetterman, is pretty, he's pissed them off a lot because he's pro-Israel. and pro like border security, and he, you know, and those are pretty popular positions in Pennsylvania where he is. So he's going to maintain popularity, but then he's really, really, really angered the left, and yet it's not going to affect his electoral prospects.
And we have to talk about this because people are making a critical mistake of
The left is
putting John
powerful on
Fetterman
TikTok
in the
and
same
Twitter.
category. We're not just, but this isn't just the left, though. Like a lot of people are putting John Fetterman in the same category of Kyrsten Sinema, senator from Arizona, when they say, like, look, there are these people who get elected as progressives, but then they go to the right. The issue of Kyrsten Sinema is also a Gen Xer who chose the wrong side. Kyrsten Sinema thought that the No Labels constituency was an actual constituency. And she clearly, when she did her kind of like radical centrist, I'm voting this thing down, I'm building my brand that way, she kind of clearly was playing to that side of the audience. But that's not an actual constituency. So John Fetterman is both going closer to the center in a way that you wouldn't have thought he would have if he looked at his early progressivism, but he's still going to a part of the center that's firmly within the Democratic Party. So he's not going to end up getting kicked out of the party effectively because he still found the right battle space to be in.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you follow politics more closely than I do. And so I think that to some degree, you're interviewing me on things that you know more than me about.
Well, I'm just gonna,
So,
this is the thing though, because I
yeah.
think this is why it's relevant though, because I've worked on the pieces that I'm most like interested in that you've written, right? So there are some democracy pieces, the industrial policy pieces, the economy, the techno optimism. I actually feel as if the work that you're doing is just totally ignored by the vast majority of up and coming political folks, when I think these are actually the central questions.
Yes,
Like
I
I
agree.
actually think
I should
the
get them to pay
central
attention to
default.
what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I
no.
wish I
So that's
could.
why I'm
I
like.
wish I
So I'm
could. I don't
bringing
know
the
how.
I'm bringing the politics into it. But yeah, so let's focus more on your areas. So I guess the real question is industrial policy. Because actually, here's actually where our worlds connect, right? So Bidenomics was like a political branding attempt to take the industrial policy moves of the Biden administration, the IRA, CHIPS Act, infrastructure, et cetera, and kind of turn that into like a Reaganomics, it's 1984 again moment. Politically, that move hasn't worked, separate from where the economy is going to be. But I think at a literal level, you've done a lot of really interesting writing about industrial policy and the struggles we're actually seeing beyond just passing the bills themselves, aka that's a political win in Congress, but there's actual problems running into it on the ground. What's going on there?
Okay, so that's really interesting. There are basically we've had several problems with implementation. We have two problems that are acute right now, at least two, and then one problem, giant problem that's looming in the background. The most acute problem is that we have no one in government who knows how to do any of this stuff. We pass laws saying these things shall be done, and nobody knows how to do it. We have no state capacity. To administer the CHIPS Act, we didn't have anyone who knew how to approve these grants. So we hired people and then we had to train them. We hired 140 people. It's like a very tiny amount of people. And we hired
So to
them to
clarify
look
what you
over
mean then, so
these
like we
grants.
passed this bill, there's tens of
Yeah.
billions of dollars of spending.
Yeah.
You needed people to say, okay, this.
Where does this money get spent? Who do we write the checks to and when? Yeah, that's what we needed. Nobody
Why
knew how
was
to
that
do
so?
that.
I this is gonna sound like this is see now this is me sounding not that you were sounding stupid, but this is me sounding stupid. That seems like an obvious thing to think about. Like, why wasn't that factored in?
Well, one thing is because we had not done something like this before, and the reason is because no one plans or thinks ahead in the world. Like,
Deeper truths.
deeper truths, no one plans or thinks ahead. One thing I've learned in life is that absolutely no one plans effectively for the future. What they do is they run into problems and then they reroute around the problems. They sort of cross the river by feeling for the stones. People make all kinds of grandiose plans for the future, but they're always vague and they're never like a step-by-step guide to like what exactly we're going to do tomorrow and the next day. Oh, so, I'm exaggerating when I say no one does this. I mean, obviously some people do this, like Tesla did
Well,
this when they were ramping
you're
up
talking
there.
at a structural level.
Yes,
They
that's right.
passed the CHIPS Act,
They had
and
no,
then
no
this
one
thing.
had any idea how to do this, and they didn't even know what they didn't know. Right. There, you have these people in government who think, okay, we've got people, we've got the CHIPS Act, we've got people in our staff That's who usually does our work for us. We've got people in these various government agencies that we named as people who are going to help with the CHIPS Act. We can call them up and say, hey, put your people on it, you know? And then like we hear back 5 months later, they're like, oh, our people couldn't handle it and didn't know what to do. And they're like, okay, gosh, oh, I guess we better hire a new agency, a new 140 people just for this. And who's going to do that hiring? Where are the people going to come from? How are we going to advertise to the people? How are we going to select the people? What qualifications do they need? So they hire those people. And then those people get to work looking at these things and saying, okay, well, how do I decide? Intel wants this money. Samsung wants this money. The startup wants this money. You know, who do I give this money to? We don't have infinite money.
I need to pause you there because you, if you were trying out for a fellowship at the Cato Institute or AEI, you were crushing it, because everything you just said is, and I want to be precise about this. Everything you just said is basically the case that a lot of folks, especially on the center right, make against doing this in the first place. So why is it that you're able to see these failures and make the critique of a lack of planning and the pitfalls therein, yet still broadly favor the policy, which is what makes you not just like an AEI fellow, obviously?
Exactly. Because the solution to difficulties of like give up and don't do the thing at all is that's pathetic. Like that's just saying, okay, well, there's going to be difficulties, therefore let us not do it. So, I mean, think about if software engineers worked like that, right? They're like, so, you know, suppose there were people who said, well, you shouldn't do any software engineering because software is bad for the world. And, you know, it's never going to work. Software engineering is too hard. So then you get a software engineer who's like, oh, God, I have this bug and like, oh, I need this app and I need this other library and blah, blah, blah. I'm hitting all these roadblocks. Let me see if I can figure them out. That's what software engineers do all day. They try to figure it out. And then imagine if you're the software engineer trying to like get the right libraries and debug and make the thing work. And then along comes this guy saying, see, I told you shouldn't do any software engineering. Just quit. Just quit. Stop it. It's not worth making this product. And that would be stupid. That would be like, I don't have, you know, I have negative words that are very strong that I want to apply to that attitude. The idea of just give up. The Cato Institute is ideologically opposed to industrial policy. It wants to have no industrial policy because it thinks not having industrial policy is a goal. So of course they're going to stand around saying, see, every time there's an obstacle or a difficulty, they're going to stand around saying, see, told you it would fail. And then, you know, like, y'all should just give up. And then, you know, anyway, I don't know.
I want to speak to this because you and I are in an interesting space in that our work is policy centric, but by dint of like our audiences and the kind of circles we run in, we spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley, like you quite literally being in SF, but you know, I'm in Austin, I'm doing Austin stuff related to tech. It's all kind of like the same circle here. How has an intersection with the tech industry informed how you think about alternate approaches to solving problems in policy and government? Because like, let me put it this way, like the reason why I bring up this metaphor is I think of the CHIPS Act failure so far as being akin to basically saying, look, we passed the funding bill and we're good to go. I actually think that's the way of it. Senators, members of Congress, a lot of people, that's how they thought about things, but that's the equivalent of you and I, let's say you and I like launch like a tech company and we convince all the A-list VCs to give us $100 million in funding. And then we're like, see, $100 million of funding. It. Like we did it.
We did it. No, that's the beginning of your task.
That is like literally the equivalent of what you kind of have happen here. So that's kind of a learning that I've taken. Are there any other learnings that you have kind of like brought, given the interesting perspective you have on these things?
So state capacity is really important. We need a bigger, better bureaucracy. That is the first thing we need to solve this problem. Of course, the Cato people really don't want that. You know, the thing we need to solve the problems that the Cato people would crow and about and trumpet and, you know, like celebrate, the things that we need to solve those problems are things the Cato people would hate even more. So first, we need a bureaucracy. The second thing we need is to prioritize results by having fewer contract requirements. And this is a thing progressives are going to hate. I said a thing Cato people were going to hate, libertarians are going to hate. Now let's talk about a thing progressives are going to hate. If you demand that you use all union labor for a task that takes 10,000 workers where there's only 4,000 union workers in the entire town, you drop that requirement. You drop that requirement. If you don't have 10,000 union workers in you know, whatever town in Arizona that you need to build this plant. And you have some requirements as, you know, you must get at least, you know, 90% of your workers must be unionized. And it takes 10,000 people to build this thing. And you can only find 4,000 unionized workers. You don't stop construction and let the unionized workers work for twice as long. You don't do that. You drop the requirement so that you don't have to have as many unionized workers, right? There's
and
a bunch
of stuff.
To build
on your
like
point,
this.
Though, I think this is where, and when I look at you, because you and I have like quite literally heard a lot of like stuff on Bidenomics. When I look at the Bidenomics failures, it's that too often there is this desire to fit all policy into a political narrative. So why was that union requirement there? It was there because at a political coalition level, the Biden administration wants to say, look, we're not only investing in a manufacturing boom, but we, unlike previous neoliberal administrations, are bringing unions back into the picture. So I think you could recognize that in politics, you have to focus on your coalition. But also, if you read the things that we read, we need to move on this chip stuff. And you actually have to have politicians who understand there's a trade-off there. And that's another gap you just kind of see there. You kind of think it's as simple as, hey, look, like we're going to have a union requirement. Unions are back. We're moving. But you see the gap when you articulate the way you're articulating it.
Yeah. Yes. We are at the beginning of knowing how to do this. So, I'll make an analogy to World War II production, right? I think it was good we did World War II production. We should have done that. It was successful and we did it correctly. And at the beginning, we hit lots and lots and lots of roadblocks. One of the roadblocks we hit was that defense contractors basically didn't know how to build enough airplanes. So we're like, okay, Ford, you build some airplanes. Ford had no idea how to build airplanes. So Ford was like, guys, after a year, they're like, guys, we built an airplane, one. And then like, it didn't work. The Roosevelt administration was extremely sympathetic to unions, and the unions came in and said, the business people that they put in charge, like the guy from GM that they put
Bill
in charge
Knudsen.
Of the effort. Yeah. Bill yep. Knudsen. He basically had this plan for how to tool up the factories, right? Okay, in the first year, we're going to get these tools, and then we're going to get these tools, and then we're going to get those tools, and then we can ramp up production. Because he sort of knew how to do this at GM. And the union guys are like, no. Why are you letting these, these neoliberal, well, they didn't use that word. Why are you letting these business guys be in charge? It's funny, the word people use has gone from business to capitalist to neoliberal, but it just means the same thing. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Market-oriented forces.
It means the owners. It means the people who are in charge make calling the shots. It is business capital and it is those things, but people just change the word they use. Anyway, but those so like Knudsen was trying to tool up these factories and then Reuther and the union came in and said no, we're going to tool these factories ourselves. We don't need these guys to tell us how to do this. We could do it all ourselves and came up with this plan. And then the Roosevelt administration was like, I love labor. You go for it. Come back to us with a detailed plan for, they had this like overall general plan, like give us a list of all the tools you'll need and blah, blah, blah. They came back and like, okay, actually we don't know how to do this. Help. And so Knudsen took back over. This story you can read about in Freedom's Forge. There were times when the union won the fight. And when the management was trying to punch down on unions too much and you can hear all about the times when the unions screwed up in Freedom's Forge. You can hear about all the times when the sort of business guys screwed up in Destructive Creation. So you got to read those books as a pair.
So the reason why I want to build on this for a second. So Arthur Herman is a colleague of mine at the Hudson Institute. And I recommended Freedom's Forge to my wife. And her reaction was, man, Arthur Herman really doesn't like units.
No, he doesn't. Like,
once again, because the thing is, Freedom's Forge was written back in 2013, where it wasn't quite written. It's one of those great like popular history that's become more and more relevant with every single day. But if you're writing this book in 2013, this book was more about the private sector and capital and then those different things. So the other book you're referring to then is Destructive Creation. Like what's the center left side there basically?
It's telling the same story from the point of view of New Dealers and unionists, instead of from the point of view of like business guys. And it's telling the same story. You can recognize that it's the same story, many of the same events, but it is It has a whole different slant. And by reading this, you understand how coalitions can work together ultimately to produce something effective, even when they disagree about who was responsible and who was getting it right and wrong, and which side is more important for society and what we should do after the war. You know, after the war, they went back to fighting. So, but they did come together effectively. So neither one of those two books contains the whole truth. The whole truth is that somehow, despite all these battles, we ended up, you know, with compromises that were effective. But the point is, we had to work those out. It took a long time to work those out. It took every stakeholder sometimes making compromises and taking losses because of this overwhelming imperative to get this production done. And in the end, we got it done. And it was the Roosevelt administration who had that guiding vision of we got to get it done, and who would sometimes rule against the unions, sometimes against the management. But yeah, and ownership. And then some, you know, they were flexibly minded. Their overwhelming imperative was to defeat the German war machine. They weren't even worried about Japan. They were like, whatever, Japan, they're in Asia, they suck.
Yeah.
Like Germany, they're the real enemy because Europe is strong. Europe is where all the manufacturing happens. And so then that has really shifted over the years.
Well, yeah, we had a Europe first policy. Okay, so this is really great because this is kind of taking us to the crescendo.
Hold on. Can I finish? Point is that we need that same consensus that we've got to get it done. And the Cato people and some of the progressives are like, if we can't do it our way, or is Cato people like, don't do it at all. And then the progressives are like, if you can't do it while giving us all the goodies we want, don't do it at all. Both of those perspectives suck and are not helpful. And we are so partisan, we're so obsessed with our partisan political battles that we have not yet unified around the dire danger that we are in from this new axis, or whatever you want to call it, the new totalitarian alliance that really wants to take us down a peg as a country and really wants to defeat us as a country. We have not yet realized that danger.
So let's crescendo here then. If we're understanding the way you're laying out the problem, you have all these different coalitional groups that have to come together to accomplish these broad tasks. So two related questions that we'll close on. One, what is the task we need to accomplish? And then two, why are we trying to accomplish it? Because, for example, I've spent times in like progressive labor groups and those sort of circles. We were at a conference that Bloomberg Beta put on. When you talk with the labor left environmental people, they're interested in the IRA because the IRA is focused on climate change and it's focused on clean tech and it's focused on clean jobs and equity and like all those literal articulations. They are not on board. They're not quite interested in it, but they could be convinced that we need to reshore manufacturing and semiconductors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. Not quite there. What they get up to. That's not what they wake up to do every morning, but they could be convinced. Zero interest in, hey, we need to deter World War III, deny Russian and Chinese advancement in Asia and Europe. They're not on board that category. And what we had in 1940 was, especially after FDR's re-election, you did have all these coalitional groups agreeing on both the aims and the broad thing. So I'm curious how you would think through, this seems to be the political challenge over the next year or two. I'm curious what you think about that.
I absolutely 100% agree. People do not understand the danger that the United States is in, the Roosevelt administration had to massively work to convince people of this. Because everybody at that time thought we have these two oceans on either side, Europe doesn't matter to us. Asia certainly doesn't matter to us. Like, why should we care? Like, why should we get involved? World War I, we got involved. And what did we get for that? Nothing except some people killed. And then World War I was widely viewed as a failure. We won the war, but then people viewed it as this giant debacle. You know, it was a bit like Iraq, right? We won and we easily won. We beat all enemies and turned the country into our proxy.
What's crazy is the timeline actually fits, because 20 years since Iraq war, 20 years, if it's 1939, yeah. Like there's something, there's a real similarity there.
Yes, there really is. And so there's this idea of, people were really, really unhappy about World War I and what happened in World War I. And they did not want to get involved in another European war. They did not want a repeat of that at all. And certainly they didn't give a rat's ass about Asia. That's just like, to them in those days, that was just some like faraway colonial place that like Europeans dominated, or who cares, right? And then, you know, as long as they don't send immigrants here to take our jobs, then we don't care. And that's what they thought. And the Roosevelt administration had to work very hard to convince people that this was worth caring about and worth being afraid of. And that if totalitarian forces dominated the continent of Eurasia, where most of the people in the world live, if they dominated that supercontinent of Eurasia, they would then act to limit and reduce America's power to the point where America was essentially had to do whatever they said. The Roosevelt administration bullshitted in that it posited a joint German-Japanese invasion of the United States and had films where they showed these arrows coming and like America shrinking as it was conquered and blah, blah, blah. That was not going to happen. No one was going to D-Day us, and like they didn't have the manpower, whatever. They would have gotten nukes and eventually nuked some of our cities, and just, you know, that's what would have happened. And they would have economically strangled us, and they would have, you know, like they would have taken Hawaii. They would have basically like restricted us from getting raw materials. They would have been able to control us. They would not have D-Day'd us. Mm-hmm. All right. China theoretically could. They have enough people to do it, but they won't. Like, it's not worth it. Like, America doesn't even want to rule ourselves at this point. Like, no one else wants to take this place over. No, but instead they, right now, America is the biggest obstacle to those countries dominating the world. If America falls, they will want to make sure America never comes back and becomes an obstacle to them dominating the world. Like, you know,
well, and I would never one modification get back on our feet. Saying it's not even as, you know, you don't have to be as apocalyptic as dominating the world. It's dominating the regions of the world, right? So like, you know, so if you're Xi Jinping, your desire isn't to, you know, conquer California. Your desire is to be the uncontested power in the Indo-Pacific. That's like the strategic level I think the Chinese are thinking. That's
maybe
the challenge.
So it's very different than it used to be. So it used to be that these colonial countries would, like, you know, we'd send, if we'd colonize a place, you know, we being like Britain or Japan or whoever, would colonize a place and then extract raw materials and then, you know, starve people for our war machine or whatever they did, right?
Settle all the rogues gallery.
Yeah, like just like have everyone work themselves into death in the diamond mines. I don't know. And so then that was what they did in the past. Now, I don't think China really wants to do that to anybody. Maybe they would. They absolutely would if, you know, they're not above that kind of thing. They don't want to. They want to make it so that whatever they want in the world, people do that for them. They don't want to conquer California in terms of like having, you know, like Chinese soldiers walking down the street pointing a gun at you and saying like, you know, hop to it, right? They want to conquer California in the sense of if someone in California doesn't want to do a business deal with a Chinese company, they call them up and it happens at favorable terms. Or, you know, if someone in California says something bad about the Chinese government that they don't like, they want that person put in prison in California or extradited. That's what they want. They want, and that is rulership. You know, if our businesses are forced to do deals, you know, with Chinese companies on their unfavorable terms, if our people are forced to not speak up about anything in China, if basically any whim of China's is enforced with force on the people of California, tell me they haven't conquered California. Just because there's no soldiers walking down the streets. There's no tanks rolling through, you know, rolling down Market Street. Fine. Who cares? They own California then, if they can boss them around like that. That is ownership. That is control. And that is what they want. And so when I say rule the world, that's what I mean. That's what I functionally mean. I functionally mean the ability to make and to extract any economic or policy or social policy they want from any nominally independent country or region anywhere in the world.
And
that is what I want.
Thing. So then from a,
that's what I think. I mean,
and from answering the question I asked of like, what are we trying to avoid?
Yes.
That is the, what are we trying to avoid? And it seems to me, this is why I ultimately think at a generational level, millennials are going to be able to get over the like obvious ideological trauma of the Iraq war, which I think is entirely justified. Because the question you're raising is fundamentally defensive. This isn't adventurism. We're not saying, oh, well, we really need to intervene in Tibet, or we really need to get boots on the ground in this part of China or this part of Russia. All we are asking is we need to maintain the status quo, which, when you go back to the start of this conversation, we're focusing on the defensive nature of warfare and the resiliency that we're trying to build when it comes to the manufacturing areas here. It seems to be those are the critical factors that differentiate us from 20 years ago.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. We really screwed up with Iraq, not because we lost the war or we won it. We screwed up because we destroyed the system that we had created after the Cold War. We created this international system where everybody plays by the rules, and America is the big country, but we follow the same rules as all the other countries do too. We then broke our own rules to just, you know, invade someone who hadn't attacked us, hadn't threatened us, and just topple them. And you know, we didn't incorporate Iraq into America, but we certainly conquered it. And that was a really bad thing that we did. It got a lot of people killed who didn't deserve to be killed, but more in the long term, what we did was we destabilized the system that we created. We had this golden opportunity at the end of the Cold War to create an enduring rules-based order, which we did not. We say now we're standing up to the rules-based order. We already destroyed the rules-based order. That's why I say territorial integrity is what we have to stand up for, because the rules-based order is gone. There's no rules anymore. We're back to the jungle. And that is obvious from all over the world. You see signs of people going back to the jungle, of countries claiming other countries' territories. You see Venezuela claiming territory in Guyana. You see, extraterritorial attacks proliferating, Pakistan and Iran bombing each other's territories. You see Israel basically doing whatever it wants. You see Houthis attacking shipping. You see Russia laying claim to Alaska now, at least implicitly. Russia, of course, trying to reconquer Eastern Europe and reincorporate into a new Russian empire, which is what they want. China is going to take over Taiwan and then dominate the other countries in Asia. Also slice off pieces of territory from India, China taking territory from Bhutan. It is a jungle out there right now. And conflict is proliferating. Everyone pretty much agrees by this point, like Pax Americana is waning, if not gone. The hegemony moment is over. Hegemony is like a silly word to talk about. Hegemon, nope. That's right. I forgot on your podcast, on my own podcast, Econ 102, I'm supposed to gesticulate and yell a lot so we to attract attention. But on your podcast, I'm very calm and sedate and serious.
That's cool. No, we're finding the middle points. Okay, here's the last question then. If the rules-based order is dead or already dying, if Pax Americana is this moment from our childhood that we're never going to get back, what are we fighting, building, working together? Like, what's our central objective here beyond just denying an invasion of Taiwan? Because that just doesn't seem to be that isn't the vision thing matters, I think. And that just isn't quite enough.
And here it is. We have you heard the expression, we must all hang together or we will surely hang separately.
Yeah,
that is true for all free countries in the world at this point. We have to stand together or we will fall one by one. We are facing the most powerful authoritarian alliance that has existed within the modern age. The overwhelming manufacturing capabilities of China combined with the natural resources and other capabilities of Iran and Russia. This is the strongest that authoritarian countries have been since pre-modern times. And that is a danger to absolutely everyone. And if America sits there and says, we'll do our own thing and lets Japan and Poland and these countries
South
and
Korea,
South Korea,
Taiwan,
if we let these countries all fall one by one, conquered by this overwhelmingly powerful alliance of bad guys, if we let that happen, we will not stand alone. We will not escape. We will fall as well. We will simply fall later. You know, it's like in this case, there is no outrunning the bear just by running faster than the other guy. You know, the bear will come for us. The bear does not have a limited appetite in this case. And the bear will come for us. If we do not forge a system of global cooperation among countries like India, like the countries of Europe, like Japan and South Korea, you know, and like, you know, Latin America, like Brazil, which is getting increasingly frustrated with China, and these countries. If we don't forge that global cooperation, we will be steamrolled. Those people will be steamrolled first, maybe not Brazil, but India and you know, Europe and Japan and South Korea will be steamrolled before us. But we will get there. We are in danger. And people do not understand that we, the people of the United States, are in danger. We're in danger of losing our free enterprise and economic autonomy to Chinese domination. We're in danger of losing our freedom of speech to Chinese and Russian, you know, domination. Someday they will be able to just dictate what we say without having to like sneakily alter the TikTok algorithm to make it say that. We are, you know, the things that we value, if you thought the post-pandemic inflation was bad, wait until you see what happens when China decides that we don't get to have some commodities or, you know, whatever, or that we have to pay double. Wait until you see that. We are in danger of that, much worse than that inflation we just went through. We are not, the oceans are no barrier. We are not safe, and we will fall. It will take us a little longer to fall than it will take our allies. But if we do not stand with them, we will be a de facto conquered in the end.
That's why I think your definition of world domination is being not purely about territorial conquest, but being about commerce and the rules and the law is really key here, because we don't have to think of ourselves as falling means, you know, battleships in the harbor. It means something different. And I actually want to close on this then. I like when you referred to like this new axis as kind of the bad guys, because I think it, you kind of triggered me, if I'm going to be honest. And part of that triggering is, I think as millennials, a huge part of our education that has not prepared us for this moment has been, we've just been constantly taught to deconstruct things. You had this post about how like, no, guys, but seriously, like America, the allies, et cetera, we were the good guys in World War II. This was in response to the controversy around Oppenheimer. And, you know, we've just been so taught that we need to think of, well, actually, well, maybe we are the baddies, you know, that like, you know, meme that goes around every once in a while. And actually it just turns out that we need to build things. We don't just need to like deconstruct our roles in society. Because when you have challenges like the ones you've outlined during this episode, they just aren't ones that can be achieved through, I think, the kind of tearing oneself down process, and which can be helpful and self-critique could be useful, as you put it in your piece, but eventually it actually leads you nowhere. And I think we have that awkward tension to navigate. So that is where I'll close it. Noah, this has been super helpful, and thank you for joining me on the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the show's mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.